Welcome to Football Uncovered, a podcast that delivers you the most weird and wonderful stories about the men and women in charge of the biggest clubs in the world. This series will bring you some truly bizarre and often unbelievable tales of the highs and lows from the people in control of the purse strings. My name is Will Brazier, and along with Richard Johnson, we are joined by our man in the know, Sporting Intelligence's Nick Harris. Today, we turn our attention to West London and Queen's Park Rangers, a team at the turn of the century who were up and down on the pitch, and it was an even bigger roller coaster off it. This is a tale of success, samba, and shocking boardroom decisions. You might think you know it all when it comes to the R's, but my friends, we barely scratched the surface. But before we get into it, if you're listening to this, please leave a rating and review to let us know what you think, and why not recommend it to a friend? If you want to hear more from Sporf and get in contact about what you want to hear from us, follow us on Twitter at Sporf. And if you want to follow Nick Harris, it's at Sporting Intel. Speaking of Nick, how are you, mate?
I'm good, thanks. Looking forward to this one.
Yeah, very exciting stuff. Rich, we've been doing our research. It's gone down memory lane. There's some truly remarkable stories coming up.
Yeah, I think QPR is an easy one to forget about in terms of how bizarre and almost, you know, one of the classic tales of weird and wonderful ownership. As well. So yeah, let's get stuck into it.
It's almost in two parts, but Nick, where are we starting?
When I had QPR in mind, I was thinking we'll look particularly at the Tony Fernandes era, because this isn't really about terrible owners and bad owners, as some of our other episodes have been. This is actually ostensibly about good owners, rich owners, certainly eccentric owners. And of course, it goes back before Tony Fernandes. So I think we're going to split it into 2 years, the 4 years before Tony Fernandes, and then the 4 years when Tony Fernandes sort of took charge and undid what had been done in the previous 4 years. And of course, those first 4 years from 2007-2011 were QPR under the stewardship of some of the richest people in the whole world, not just in Britain or European football. And they're notorious, or what became notorious, as their four-year plan to get out of the Championship and into the Premier League, a plan that was eventually successful. So we're going to split it into the before Fernandes and the after Fernandes eras. And, you know, just to remind people, a lot of people will have seen the four-year plan documentary about those years at QPR. Brilliant piece of award-winning documentary making. And that is available, certainly in the UK, free on Amazon Prime. If people want to go and watch it, I'd certainly recommend it. But we had Bernie Eccleston and his fellow Formula One magnate Flavio Briatore, plus Lakshmi Mittal, who at that point was the seventh richest person in the world, and his son-in-law, Amit Bhatia. And they took over the club that was on the brink with $18.5 million of debts. And they let film director Matt Hodgson film them for 4 years, giving him complete carte blanche to show whatever he captured in that time. And it was an extraordinary, extraordinary period.
So I guess at that point, QPR gets taken over by, as you say, not just like wealthy within football realms. They are sort of billionaires on a truly global scale. QPR fan, you'd be salivating. At the thought.
It was front page news that they would suddenly become technically the richest football club in the world by the wealth of their combined owners. And these people were successful in sport and in business and powerful and loaded. And you must have thought as a QPR fan that this was just going to take you to the Champions League.
And this was obviously as well around the era when City had obviously were getting the money and you know there was a lot of this going on, you know, kind of in and around football, wasn't there, in terms of the footballing sugar daddies as such, you know, actually going from rags to riches.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Abramovich had been in a bit earlier, 2003. The Glazers arrived, albeit not with loads of their own money to put in, a bit later, 2005. Sheikh Mansour at Manchester City was 2008. So these guys were in sort of the year before Sheikh Mansour, but seriously loaded people. They weren't making big promises. They were saying they wanted to get to the Premier League within 4 years, which I guess is a fairly modest ambition with all the money they've got. But the way they went about it, and particularly, you know, on camera during the four-year plan documentary, it's chairman Gianni Paladini, who takes up a lot of screen time, and his interactions with Flavio Briatore particularly, who was clueless about football, but thought that he, you know, should and could make all the decisions right down to picking the team, that kind of stole the show. And it's farcical at points.
what might be useful as well, before we sort of jump into some of these great anecdotes, which thankfully, because they recorded the documentary, we have access to what's gone on. Can you explain, Nick, the premise of the four-year plan? So, you know, what did they like set out to do and achieve and essentially document?
Basically, they as owners decided that they were going to run the club in a sustainable, sensible fashion. Obviously, they didn't at all. It was chaos. But that was the idea, that they were sensibly going to build up and support a manager with a really well-organised club on and off the pitch, and just have that ambition of taking it to the Premier League within 4 years. It was fairly simple, but obviously it ended up being chaos. Not least because they changed the managers so frequently and disparaged the managers and undermined the managers and slagged the managers off behind their backs and to their faces. It was crazy.
I think it kind of feels as well like this case of where you've got successful businessmen in other areas and in other sporting areas, ultimately, you know, with Briatore and Eccleston. And they probably very much take the view of, well, we can make it work in this area, so let's take what we know and our approach and apply that to, you know, a currently struggling club and, yeah, make them world beaters. So I guess that's probably part of the thinking behind doing that. And Will, you know, from your perspective, if that happened to Birmingham, to the Blues, you're going to be excited, right?
Well, I think it's what we've now called on this podcast the League Cup syndrome, where it's, do you want League Cup success or relegation? And I've already stated my case that I want the League Cup and nothing else. But I mean, going into the documentary, I mean, I think it's great because the documentaries we get now are great, but they do feel a little bit watered down, especially like the All or Nothing.
They're sanitised.
Yeah, it's a bit of a...
Well, you've got All or Nothing, which, yeah, is like...
The first All or Nothing was very PR.
Yeah, it was. Although the access is great, they do feel PR. Hodgson, and Nick, correct me if I'm wrong, I think with him, when he requested to be able to do this, they gave him the freedom for total editorial control.
Initially, he said, look, can I film you for the first year? And they said yes, and that was fine. I don't think they kind of seen any of the rushes. They can't have known what he had, because then, you know, at the end of year one, he said, look, this is a 4-year plan, how about I just carry on filming? So I don't think they weren't seeing what he had, and they'd given him carte blanche to do what he wanted with it. And it didn't actually come out till a year later, after the 4-year plan had been sort of achieved in 2012. So I think all those things combined to make it, you know, something really unique. Obviously, there's lots of different foreign languages going on here. So whether they thought that if they were speaking in Italian, you know, he wouldn't be able to understand them, or wouldn't pay a translator to translate what they were saying. So a lot of the juicy stuff is in Italian, and then it's translated, you know, them slagging off players or managers or, you know, anyway, it all adds up to quite a good, entertaining film.
The highlight of how good this documentary is and how unfiltered it is the fact, I think it's when Ian Dowie's in charge, and they've signed a certain Gavin Mahn who's on the bench. And I think Briatore, speaking in Italian, gets on the phone and rings up and says, get Gavin Mahn on, which is a sentence I think even Gavin Mahn wouldn't even believe was being said, for a corner. Briatore demands he comes on and he actually scores from the corner.
He does. And then Briatore is, you know, going absolutely mental, like, this is exactly what I intended to happen. This is why I should be picking the team. I mean, the scenes in here that are unbelievable. At one point, they're discussing before a match where they're discussing the method by which they, from the director's box, will be able to give instructions for substitutions and tactics from the director's box to the dugout, and how they'll have to do it by text rather than ringing, because it'll be obvious then that they're giving instructions. You know, at different points, Briatore is referring to one of his own managers as that fucking hooligan. And another time, when Ainsworth is in charge, that prick in the dugout. If we just run quickly through the managers they had and what they did in the four seasons that they were there. In the first season, 7-8, they had two managers, John Gregory and Luigi Di Canio. We all remember him, don't we? No. 2008-09, Dowie, Ainsworth, and then Paolo Souza. At 9-10, Jim Magilton, Paul Hart and Neil Warnock. And then eventually it was 2010-11, Warnock managed to last the whole season. But just a succession of managers and chaos throughout. Again, one of the sort of extraordinary things was the Dexter Blackstock incident. At that point, he was the leading scorer in a team that were really struggling for goals. And Gianni Paladini decided to loan him out to Nottingham Forest. And there's this scene where you've got Fitz Hall sort of shouting on camera, don't sign it, Dex, in terms of the loan forms. And then he turns to Paladini. This is Fitz Hall saying, top striker, and we're sending him to Forest. Why are you sending our top scorer away? To which Paladini responds, it's not me in it. i.e. meaning it was Flavio Briatore who decided to send him out on loan when they really needed someone to score goals. And then the manager, Paulo Sousa at that time, is asked about this in a press conference after it had been announced. And he told the press that it wasn't his decision, he was unhappy. And then Palladini phones Briatore and says, that idiot is going to turn the fans against us. They're saying it's our fault that Dexter Blackstock is going to Nottingham Forest. And the management respond by sacking Paulo Sousa.
You know, I think kind of what's clear about all this is that the ownership at that time, they're egotists and they probably want to control some of the minutiae of the running of certain aspects of the club more than they should, i.e. dictating signings.
I mean, there was one point where Briatore is watching a reserves match between QPR and Southampton, and he's being filmed in the stands, and the goalkeeper makes a mistake, the Saints score a goal, and Briatore shouts, "He's so fucking stupid, the goalkeeper is shit." And then, and Dowie, I think, yeah, Dowie was the manager at that point, and he's listening to all this, and then Dowie's sitting with them in the stands watching the reserves match, and Briatore says, right, go and put the striker on, I think it was Tomasi, he says, go and put him on, we want to see how he does it, and Dowie sort of stands up and has to go down to the pitch side and tell his coaching staff to make the substitution, because the owners told him to do it, and then you hear Dowie sort of picked up on a mic, whispering to one of his coaching staff about, you know, the interference that's going on.
As a manager within football, like, that must be one of the most frustrating and just, I guess, soul-destroying things when you're getting told by people who, you know, don't know the technical aspects of the game like you do, you're getting told what to do.
Because the managers that we listed, or now we sort of, like, snuff our nose a little bit to them, but, like, Ian Dowie still had good credit, obviously Ainsworth and Sousa, and even, like, Jim McGilton was sort of like a, I don't know, like an up-and-coming sort of manager at the time. Yeah. They were trying to get the right people in.
I mean, Sousa's introductory speech to the squad was fantastically unimpressive, really. He's standing there addressing the team with Briatore next to him and basically saying, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, what I want you to do is I want you to work hard and to try and be better players. And that was pretty much the content of his supposedly motivational speech. So I've actually found Sousa slightly underwhelming. And he was never going to survive very long in this sort of environment. But it was that towards the end of that season, 8-9, where he got the boot, that there's footage of a QPR versus Sheffield Wednesday game, and the fans are chanting, "We want our Rangers back." There's a lot of anti-Briatore stuff throughout the first few years. And he's filmed outside talking to fans, saying to these group of fans who are complaining about it that he wants the names of all those who were booing me, or I will sell the club. And then the fans would go, no, we appreciate that you've saved us once. don't do that, please.
Just with that, obviously, Briatore is clearly like one of the most colourful characters here. But what's sort of Eccleston's role in all of this? Because he's not sort of bubbling up to the top in some of these extraordinary stories.
No, Eccleston's actually only in it sporadically. There's one point early on when I think it's Amit Bhatia is in a car with Briatore and they see a fanzine seller, and there's a cover of the fanzine has got like a big picture of Briatore and then a little Eccleston next to him, almost as if Eccleston is a ventriloquist dummy, right. You know, this dream pairing. And Briatore's going, "Oh, we have to get one of those. We have to get one of those." But Eccleston is only in it fleetingly. You know, he wasn't anywhere near as hands-on as Briatore and Palladini, who's central to it. And obviously Amit Bhatia, who's also central to it and comes across reasonably well.
What was your sort of dealings and thoughts on Briatore? Because I only know him from his time with Renault, and I mean, even then they had success and controversy with like deliberately crashing the car and everything like that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously his reputation went before him. He was a larger-than-life character. He was wealthy. He thought that the wealth gave him the power to do whatever he wanted. And that is absolutely clear from his time at QPR. He just thought that he would do things his way. And that was it. There was just no truck with it. He would run things the way that he saw fit. And if you didn't agree with him, then stuff it. And that's ultimately what the relationship he had with his managers. I think they knew that they were going to come in and probably be told what to do, and those who could live with that survived, and those who didn't were out pretty quickly. And there was this succession of managers coming out in the 9-10 season. Jim McGilton, he's not there very long. There were some spectacular goals during his short reign at the club, and then he was gone, And then he ended up leaving by mutual consent, having had an altercation with an opposition official during a defeat at Watford. In the film, it's quite funny because the next manager is Paul Hart. You see a few seconds of footage and it says Paul Hart is appointed. And then there's a sort of blank of a few seconds and then it just says he left less than a month later. So that was 29 days and 5 matches. And he was a permanent manager. He was the sixth manager in 2.5 years of the Briatore reign. Wow. And at this point, the fans are hammering their fists against the glass, shouting, Briatore is a wanker. The police are called because it's getting quite tasty. And then they're chanting, 4-year plan, you're having a laugh. So this is the context. It's around this time when you've got Sousa in and out, Magilton in and out, Paul Hart in and out. And then it's a case of, right, who can take over and steady the ship? And then it cuts to Amit Bhatia on the phone. I think he's on the phone to Briatore saying that he's found the guy who will take them to the chosen land, you know, the manager with the profile and the temperament. And then he announces that's Neil Warnock and he signed a 3.5-year deal. And Warnock comes in and that's us into the 10-11 season, which actually ends up being the season they do go back up, but not without some complications along the way.
Obviously, smart move bringing in Warnock, you know, something recommended as a tonic to all struggling clubs, either in relegation trouble or wanting glory. And so all seemingly going well, but actually it was some of the recent changes in regulations around third-party ownership that sort of landed them in hot water and actually potentially put it all in jeopardy, which definitely would have pissed the fans off even more than to date. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, Nick?
Yeah, so as you said, it was a remarkable start to the season. It was actually QPR's best start to a season for 63 years. They had 22 points after 8 games, 34 points after 16 games, 41 points after 19 games, top of the table, scoring loads of goals. Warnock's a hero. In the November financial planning meeting, you've got Amit Bhatia sitting at the table sort of explaining that a championship club gets typically £2 million a year from TV money. But in the Premier League, that's at least £42 million. Even then, it was a minimum of sort of £42 million. And if you end up staying up for a few years, you're into sort of 80, 120, £150 million. Really sort of emphasising the financial gulf that we all know about that's been in place for a long while now. So there's all this optimism that they're heading there, they're absolutely on course. And then suddenly they're mired in this controversy around this player, Alejandro Forlan, who's been signed. And there's suddenly a question mark that they've broken all kinds of FA rules around third-party ownership. Paladini is in scenes throughout the documentary, is protesting his innocence and saying it's all fine. And that media reports are untrue and that it's all going to be great and they're not going to have a points penalty. But this really is starting to hang over them. And then the Sun run a story saying that FA sources saying they're going to be hit with a massive points penalty, which puts the whole thing in jeopardy. You know, if that was going to happen and that they were going to have a points deduction, then everything they'd worked for 4 years would be in jeopardy. Briatore clearly doesn't believe Paladini. Paladini is on camera increasingly nervously claiming to the documentary makers that he hasn't done anything wrong. And then the next minute he's on the phone sort of pleading to Briatore, and Briatore saying to him, if you haven't done anything wrong, why is everybody saying we're going to get a points deduction and a massive fine? And so this tension starts to build up, and that sort of really frames the last sort of the run-in to the end of that season, the 10-11 season, with the promised land in sight, but the threat that it'll all be taken away, hanging over them.
So we sort of actually see in the documentary some of this sort of tension documented and escalated. It does end up actually coming down to them actually not knowing what's going to happen until the final game of the season. So they are in pole position. As far as everyone's concerned, they are going to finish champions, but there's a chance that actually it may be taken away a few days later because of this potential deduction. So how did that happen? Because we end up with obviously an FA investigation to determine what the outcome was. And that actually ended up coming to a climax on the final day of the season. So we've got these like multiple kind of amazing storylines going on.
Yeah, so you've got Warnock is the hero. They're on the brink of guaranteeing going up. The Sun runs his story saying that there'll be a 15-point deduction and that the whole thing's in jeopardy. There's a massive kerfuffle. Paladini's in the ship with Briatore. Briatore's worried it's all going to go wrong. Warnock is sort of telling people that he's been assured that it's all going to be fine. They play versus away at Watford. They need 1 point to guarantee being champions and therefore going up. They actually win 2-0 with a Turat scoring a fantastic goal. What a player he was when he turned it on. And then the last game of the season, it was at home to Leeds, and they'd been told, I was sent from Scotland to Loftus Road to cover this match, not because of the football, but because the announcement was going to be made in the morning of the game, we were told, about, you know, the points deduction or not. So the crowds were gathered outside. I was on the street outside the stadium, sort of doing a vox pop with the fans. Palladini was sort of pacing up and down, talking to fans, looking really, really nervous. And somebody came up to him and whispered something in his ear, and he like punched the air and just sort of shot back into the stadium. In the documentary, you can see him running through the corridors, obviously trying to find Briatore or whatever, because the news had come through that there was no points deduction whatsoever. And he was just running around like an absolute madman. And so that was it. Before kickoff, we knew that they were champions and they were, in fact, going to the Premier League. And then they lost 2-1 to Leeds, but nobody cared because they were back. So that's the four-year plan realised. And I know we've squeezed this into about 20 minutes. QPR fans certainly won't forget those 4 years, or Briatore or Palladini, or a period when they weren't bad owners and they didn't have bad intentions and they were rich people. But just shows you how chaotic it can be when you've got such enormous personalities involved.
Can I just ask something, Nick? In terms of that actual investigation into the third-party ownership of Farland, so they did get found guilty on a couple of charges and got a fine rather than a points deduction.
Yeah.
How did all that work? Because that still seems like they're guilty of something.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a proportionality. I think Palladini had obviously argued that he hadn't either known or intended to break the rules. I mean, it basically came down to small print and whether it was a technical breach or whether it was a deliberate effort to subvert the rules and cheat. And obviously they convinced the FA that, you know, they'd broken the rules, but they hadn't meant to. So it didn't end up, for example, in the way that the, you know, the Tevez and Mascherano, you know, to West Ham had ended up, which was a deal brokered by an agent, Kia Drabshan, who will come in a bit later, where the repercussions of that were that West Ham ended up staying up that season at the expense of Sheffield United, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I think there was something like, eventually West Ham had to pay, was it £20 million to Sheffield United in compensation, where there was quite clearly a really egregious breach. And the players, you know, who'd been involved were so successful that they made a material difference to a season. Obviously, that wasn't the case at QPR, as ruled by the FA.
Do you think they almost got away with it a little bit because it had dragged on for so long, and like for the people in charge at the time, for them to have champions but then take the champions away would just be a horrible look?
I don't think so. I don't think the FA would have gone soft on them for that. I think they just genuinely found that they looked at the details, they decided a fine was appropriate. I mean, they could have decided to dock them some points and they still could have gone up. But they didn't. I mean, I don't also know the source of the Sun story, they said at the time, was an FA source telling them. So whether there was something internal that someone at the FA had, in fact, given some information to Sun and therefore there was a change of mind because of that, I don't know. I genuinely don't know. But I don't think, you know, even a small points penalty, they still would have gone up. So in the end, it didn't really matter.
The four-year plan is obviously well documented in that documentary. It's a great watch. But now the second part of the eight-year plan, a new four-year plan, how many other plans do you want? Tony Fernandez comes in. But I didn't realise, Nick, obviously reading from your notes, that he was in line to take over a different club.
Yeah, he's actually a West Ham fan. And it was spring 2011, I think it was May, that he nearly bought, or he thought he was on the verge of buying 51% of that club from Gold and Sullivan, who obviously owned it and still own it. They even sent an official to Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, where he was based, to meet him. And then Sullivan slagged off Fernandez in public, saying the offer was pathetic. Fernandez took to Twitter to criticise the West Ham owners and say that he'd made a great offer, and that whole thing fell apart. And a couple of months later, there he is, August 2011, actually buying the majority shareholding in QPR from Bernie Eccleston. Eccleston, by that point, had a 66% stake. So Fernandez becomes the majority owner for about 35 million quid, and the Mittal family retain their stake. And Amit Bhatia from the Mittal family, he was restored to his position as vice chairman. The colourful Mr. Palladini was removed as chairman. And then Fernandez sort of started to show what his business muscle by introducing Malaysia Airlines, and Air Asia announcing sponsorship of QPR shirts for two seasons, and that brought in millions and millions of pounds. So people thought, okay, this guy, he owns airlines, he's a good, solid businessman, he had big ambitions for West Ham, and now he's going to, you know, carry on and, the four-year plan, take QPR to the next level, not just in the Premier League, but, you know, up to the Champions League or whatever.
He was also involved in F1. So was that, do you think, did he buy it because he was obviously good mates with Eccleston and he thought, right, we'll sort him out here?
I think he would have known him through that, but he clearly wanted, like many, many foreign owners did around this time, as we've discussed in quite a few cases, he saw that the Premier League was just the place to buy a football club in mm-hmm. terms of global branding, in terms of image enhancement for your reputation, in terms yep. of excitement. You know, it was a good place to take have a football club, not least because there was so much money. If you could make it work, you would be making a lot of money.
What did you make of the takeover?
You know, we couldn't anticipate what would have happened, but it seemed that after the chaotic sort of way that Briatore and Paladini and had run the club for 4 years, that this was going to be a guy who was a really successful businessman in the airline industry, sort of promising to bring in staff and methods and, you know, a whole way of working that would now stabilise QPR and take them to the next level on and off the pitch. So there were no questions in anyone's mind at this point that Tony Fernandes was a serious businessman who would probably apply the principles that had worked for him in his other area of business to football. But obviously what happened, as so often happens when these people buy football clubs, as in rich business people who haven't necessarily worked in football before buy football clubs, is they just... circumstance just, you know, runs away from them, and they end up making what is in hindsight crazy decisions, hiring managers who are inappropriate, are not really what the club needs, often coming with hangers-on or agents who are encouraging the managers to buy lots of players. And what I mean, we can go through the signings by season, but ultimately he let managers and agents spend an absolute load of money on loads of players who didn't work, and then ended up sacking those managers as well. So Warnock, the manager who'd taken QPR, he was sacked after a winless run of, I think it was 12 games, and he was replaced by Mark Hughes. Now that might, on the face of it, seem like, you know, a decent appointment. Mark Hughes had, you know, had a reasonable managerial track record. He's a big name, he could attract players. But Mark Hughes, for some reason, probably... for the bottom line, by then had Kia Jarabchin as his agent, which immediately to me sort of rang alarm bells. I mean, just because of the sort of things that Kia Jarabchin had been involved in terms of football agency, but also his other business and his background and his various links to oligarchs and question marks over his business dealings in South America, particularly Brazil. And I thought that rang alarm bells for me.
And then just on the signings, I mean, obviously Tony Fernandes outside of football, well-established businessman, obviously really good at what he does, but doubles the wage bill. And I mean, the names that they're bringing in are just like, I think nowadays the scouting network every club has is phenomenal, but these are just like, he did all right in the Premier League. He's had a couple of appearances in the Premier League.
And just the sheer amount of players that he brought in those first few seasons every summer and January. So just in that season alone, amongst the players signed were Jay Bothroyd, Kieran Dyer, Danny Gabbidon, DJ Campbell. We always remember DJ Campbell, don't we?
From
Blackpool. Legend. Joey Barton. Can you remember Joey Barton? Luke Young, Armand Traore, Sean Wright Phillips, Anton Ferdinand, Ned Maduwa, Jibril Sissé and Bobby Zamora. That's just in one season.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
And it's funny because they're all, like, to your point, Will, they're all sort of like these familiar, like, recognisable names, but not sort of necessarily, they've just been there. They've been good squad players and, yeah, had those maybe standout seasons like DJ and sort of other people, but all sort of then being put on big salaries because they were probably at the peaks of their powers, really.
Yeah, I mean, let's not damn them with faint praise for all his troubles off the pitch. Joey Barton was a very, very good footballer at his peak, and most of these players were internationals, either full internationals, like Kieran Dyer and Sean Wright Phillips played for England, didn't he? And you know, most of these guys were international footballers. But just the sheer volume of them, you're not going to bring in these many players to an already bloated squad and have sort of be able to achieve consistency and balance.
So, Nick, for me, I wanted to dig down a little bit deeper, was like that relationship between Mark Hughes and Kieran Darabjic. Obviously, he's got him as his agent.
Yes.
I mean, I've had personal... not personal stuff, but we had it with Blues with Gary Monk and his interaction with his agent, and obviously that resulted in him getting the sack. But how much would Keir have been involved?
I mean, he himself, after a lot of criticism and all this sort of didn't go the right way in the long term, was sort of insisted he was not really involved in many of these transfers. But the fact is, he's obviously... a key advisor to the manager, and the manager is obviously advising the owner about, you know, the sort of players he needs. So his influence is definitely there. I mean, maybe not as obviously, say, as in recent times at Arsenal, where it's very obvious. So many players, as you said, what happens when you buy loads and loads of players? You know, often it's not great. They did, in fact, survive that season. They went into the final game of the 11-12 season, not safe from relegation. And so they could have gone down. And in fact, they lost 3-2 to Man City in that game with that Aguero goal. But Bolton needed a win to overtake QPR, and they only drew. And so they went down instead. So skin of the teeth, they actually survived that season. I mean, what happened during that first Mark Hughes season was the wage bill the year before Mark Hughes arrived was 30 million quid, basically. And in that season, it nearly doubled to 58 million quid.
And that's with the signings you previously mentioned.
So that was the signing I'd previously mentioned. So the wage bill had doubled. So the 11-12 wage bill was 91% of their income. And they lost £22 million that year. And their debt rose to £89 million. I mean, you know, football finance is sort of my thing. And even at the time, it was notable.
91% obviously sounds like a big number. But what's the sort of normal proportion of that?
Your wage bill to your turnover to be really, really healthy doesn't really want to exceed sort of 60-65%. And if you can keep it down towards 50%, then that's good going. So 91% is way, way above what is sensible and safe.
And then we get to the signings, which...
And then this is before the wage bill has doubled, before they sign Park Ji-sung, Robert Green, Andy Johnson, Junior Hoylett, Ryan Nelson, Samba Diakite, Jose Bisingua, Julio Cesar, Esteban Granero, Stefan Mbia, Fabio Da Silva on loan, Loic Remy, Chris Samba, Jermaine Genus, and Andros Townsend. I mean, that's another entire squad of players.
Even just looking at that, knowing the time, but there's no one under there that's like under £40,000-£50,000 a week.
No, exactly. I mean, the wage bill, I think we'll come on to it later, but the wage bill that season, the 12-13 season, rose from 91% of income to 195% of income.
So basically, for every pound they got as income, they were spending £1.95 on wages.
On wages.
But Nick, like, you've spent like time with these different like successful business people in their own right. Just what happens when they get into football and just throw every sort of business nounce that they've ever had?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is just what seems to happen time and again. And this isn't because Tony Fernandez is a bad man or whatever. He's just hiring managers who he thinks is going to do a good job for him and then letting them spend his money and just writing the checks, I guess, in the hope that they'll stay in the Premier League and then not just stay there, but get into the Champions League. And once you're in the Premier League and you've got this £50 million a year of TV money, as it was then, and a prospect that it will keep going up, because this was an era when there was, you know, inflation for every TV deal was going up and up and up. And the thought of losing that, you know, losing out on that and getting relegated is terrifying, because suddenly you're saddled with massive losses, which is obviously what ended up happening. They did end up going down, and they did have a massive wage bill and lose loads of money, and then they got into all sorts of extra trouble because of the financial fair play rules in place in the football league. But we'll come on to that in a bit. So yeah, I guess it's a combination of fear of failure and what that will ultimately mean, and sort of the prospect that it might just work and that these managers and players will help you achieve success and glory. It must also be quite addictive. And if you're a very rich person and it's initially tens of millions of pounds and then a few hundred million pounds, you know, maybe you can ultimately afford it.
I think that's a good point in terms of what you say there, Nick, about it. Yeah, this addictive nature to it. I think this is actually, I don't want to sort of take your words here so you can build on that. But I think there's one interesting point that is around when they actually got relegated and Fernandez actually having this feeling that he has been exploited by agents and managers, yeah. Which, you know, from a financial sense. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So what happened is Hughes, he took 4 points from his first winless 12 games of that 12-13 season and he was sacked. Fernandez then appointed Harry Redknapp as his successor and Redknapp got them relegated. Shortly after they went down, Fernandez said he felt he'd been exploited since he took over at Loftus Road, which is sort of, you know, a bit ironic really, because nobody forced him into spending the money, but ultimately he'd spent an estimated £50 million by that point.
That might be that naivety, you know, similar to what we've seen at Venky's at Blackburn, where again, you could argue there that there's been exploitation.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as we discussed it in the Venky situation, they had sort of actually been hoodwinked, really, and they had been manipulated by people who were running the club and telling them that they were going to do one thing but doing another, and it obviously crashed and burned in the way that we explored in episode one of this series. Whereas there was never the suggestion with Fernandez. Fernandez sort of willingly put his money in, thought that he was going to have success with the managers that he hired and the players they bought for him and wrote the checks. But he ended up saying, I don't think I will be exploited anymore. I think I allowed myself to be exploited, but that's my choice. I mean, it's quite contradictory. Yeah. Isn't he? He's saying I've been exploited, but it was my choice to be exploited. Maybe that's a good way to put it. He was exploited, but he let himself be exploited. Agents are trying to get the best contracts and there are no two ways about it. I had to pay premiums, he said. I've seen all of the parts that make football quite, maybe immoral is a strong word, but they would sell their grandmother to do something. It's all part of the football ecosystem. And that's quite damning when you've got an owner who's just been relegated, basically saying that agents and football is immoral and that he's been exploited. But on the other hand, he let himself be exploited. But, you know, imagine feeling exploited after hiring one manager whose agent is Kia Jurabchin and then sacking him and replacing him with Harry Redknapp, who forever needs a few more bodies in. So, but that's where we are, and their troubles had barely started.
Yeah, I guess there as well, like around that point of him feeling like he's been exploited, it probably goes back to the classic thing in any circumstance where, you know, the more you want something, you know, the more that he's desperate for something, he kind of loses that negotiating power, and ultimately, you know, the greed and the desperation to, yeah, stay in the Premier League, to ultimately sort of use that obviously that broadcasting money as well as an ability to at least recoup or make some money has probably left him exposed in a number of ways where ultimately then, you know, the agents, you know, could be like, oh, you definitely need a Park Ji-sung on 130 grand a week or whatever it was because he's going to help you do XYZ and obviously a number of other large volumes of players that potentially that was probably the sell really.
Yeah, and he was now in a classic catch-22 situation because he's got a club back in the Championship where he really doesn't want to be for all sorts of reasons. But he's also got these relatively new Football League financial fair play rules in place. They're quite complex, but basically they were in place to prevent a club overspending in order to buy success. So there were limits on how much you could spend, because what they didn't want to do was have sort of a financial arms race with all the clubs spending loads more than they actually earn and therefore getting into really financial trouble. So the FFP rules were basically there to protect clubs from themselves, is the simplistic way. But what that meant is that if QPR had a big wage bill in that 13-14 season in the Championship and bought more players for Warnock and spent more money on wages and therefore did massively overspend in order to get back promoted again, which they did get promoted in that season back to the Premier League. But the problem was, if they did that, then they faced the potential of having a massive fine under these financial fair play rules. And the way it worked is, as it looked likelier and likelier that they were going to get back up again, I did a piece in the paper that was, you know, projecting how much they were going to lose and what their fine could look like. And because there was a specific tariff, again, very technical, but basically for every £1 million you went above of losses that you went above a certain limit, you were going to have a fine equating to roughly £1 million for every £1 million you'd overspent. So at that point, it looked like they might lose. The projections were something like £70-80 million that season. And therefore, on the tariff board, the fine looked like, you know, before deductions for some technical reasons, looked like it could be 40, 50,
wow,
£60 million. So even in that season, Harry was allowed to sign Danny Simpson, Richard Dunn, Carl Henry, Charlie Austin, Gary O'Neill, Matt Phillips, Yossi Benayoun, Aaron Hughes, and others. So they already had a big wage bill. They were signing new players. They were paying even more money. And what actually happened is they ended up losing £70 million, basically, in that season and going back down to the Championship, from which they've never returned. Mm-hmm. And then there was this massive legal row that went on for more than 4 years after they'd been promoted, with the Football League, about how big the fine would be and how they would pay it. So it took more than 4 years of legal arguments and deals and plea bargaining and all sorts of things behind closed doors. I mean, this went on so long and involved so many lawyers that part of the £42 million settlement was agreed in the end, announced in July 2018 over this incident. And of that, that included £3 million just for the EFL's legal costs for this, wow, for this legal battle. So you have a four-year legal battle and end up with a £42 million bill for breaching FFP rules. And that's obviously something that has been contributing to their troubles even since.
Just throwing it to sort of a more modern day circumstance, because it's still sort of that win or bust mentality, even though those rules are in place. Because I remember when Wolves went up, obviously their percentages of spending on wages to profit was ridiculous, but obviously they got out of there.
Yeah.
Is that sort of still the case now?
I think it is. I think it's maybe not as crazy as it was for QPR in this particular season. You know, that season they lost £70 million basically, and they had a £75 million wage bill in the Championship, which to that point was the biggest wage bill the Championship had ever seen. £75 million on wages. There's clubs that have been in the Premier League, you know, in recent years, not least Sheffield United now in 2020, who have a lower wage bill than that. And that's in the top division with the Premier League money. So it's not quite as crazy. Although having said that, there's been all sorts of examples in recent years of football clubs selling their stadiums to themselves in the Championship in order to sort of basically count that as extra income so as not to fall foul of FFP rules. I mean, Derby did that, didn't they? And Sheffield Wednesday, I think. There's obviously a big debate that needs to take place about rebooting football and making it more financially sustainable. Personally, I'd probably go for some sort of much more enforced salary controls. Mm. Maybe not a hard salary cap, although that is being proposed around, I think the suggestion is about 18 million in the Championship, that there should be a salary cap. Personally, I maybe wouldn't go for that. I might go for more of a luxury tax model, so that if you want to spend more on wages and you can afford to spend more on wages and you're good for the money and you can guarantee it and you spend over what the salary cap is, then you would pay a tax which goes to central funds to sort of help out. That may be the sort of model, you know, I would favour. There are now salary caps come into League One and League Two in recent times, and the Championship, I think, does need something like that.
Salary caps, for me, though, they feel like they're made to be exploited. You know, like we've seen in rugby.
Yeah.
Where, like, then you end up with probably some teams playing the game, honestly.
Yeah.
And then others who are, yeah,
of course, people,
just exploiting the loopholes.
People will try and exploit the loopholes and break it, and that generally happens. But in principle, salary caps can and do work. It would have to be voluntary, because I think technically they're against the law, so there would be that aspect of it. But, you know, they work in different ways in American sports. Obviously, there's luxury tax in baseball. There's sort of squad caps and salary caps in NFL. It works in IPL cricket, which is a really successful tournament with sort of lots of competitive balance. I don't think football really has an appetite for it. I don't think rich owners have an appetite for salary caps. And there's a lot of rich owners in the championship. There's a lot of billionaires in the championship. But this is sort of one sort of cautionary tale of what can happen. Not because Tony Fernandez is stupid or corrupt or bad, a bad person, but because, like he said, he let himself be exploited and ended up with a club that's not been back to the Premier League and isn't showing many signs of getting back there soon. And when you look at the annual losses from his years in charge, 23 million the first year, 65 million the next year, 70 million the year after, 46, 11, then they had a break-even year, 38 million, 10 million. That's £269 million of losses in his first years in charge before last season, when he obviously would have got hammered because of COVID and everything. So, you know, with a wage bill that peaked, you know, in the championship at £75 million, it's just not sustainable. And it's, you know, QPR fans probably almost look back fondly on the first four-year plan of Briatore and co.
But now you even look at the way he's running the club now, it's almost taken him, when did he take it? It's like 9 years on how to sustainably run a club, like selling a beer Eze, and they've got great youth prospects there, haven't they?
Yeah, and a wage bill sort of in the 20s of 20 million. So, you know, they've got a wage bill that's more than £50 million lower now than it was 6 years ago, you know. And the club is being run, obviously, much more sustainably. But, you know, that 14-15 season, when they finished rock bottom of the Premier League, even then, with Harry still there before Harry quit, just looking at it yesterday, I'd sort of forgotten, you know, they signed Rio Ferdinand. You know, Rio Ferdinand was playing for Harry at QPR that season. Stephen Corker, Leroy Fer, Alex McCarthy, I wonder where he is now. Sandro from Spurs. You know, they were still signing big name players, obviously on big wages. And then they ended up finishing rock bottom. But there you go. That's the story of QPR, which apart from obviously maybe Tony Fernandez's perception of having been hoodwinked or conned a little bit by agents and stuff, it isn't really a story about some corruption. It's just about the chaos of being a football club owner, wanting to be in control and making decisions that ultimately cost you a lot of money and don't work out. That's the hazard.
I think that's a good thing with this one. It's not necessarily one of these which has ended in total tragedy. I think, like, as you said, Will, he's sort of taken a while, but he's learned from his mistakes. And I think ultimately it's kind of one of those which just highlights, particularly with obviously those record losses with the championship and these sort of insane wage bills, of just how quickly these type of things can get out of control. And yeah, I think hopefully, you know, it doesn't, that they are kept sustainably run, so they don't end up in any more problems.
I think the big conclusion for me is, if Chris Samba's your star earner, that's when you need to sort of take a step back and really have a long, hard look at yourself.
Hey, listen, at one point they had Samba, Ryan Nelson, you know, absolute two central pillars from some sort of Blackburn's defence, you know, 10 years ago or so. I would take that any day of the week, Will, so don't speak ill of him.
I think they'd obviously taken some advice from Venky's on recruitment, hadn't they?
Well, were you involved in that one at all, Nick?
Not
was I
at
asking?
All. No.
No. No. Just double checking. Right, yeah, we've learned a lot there. Conclusion, Tony Fernandez, slightly naive, but he's still there, and maybe QPR will once again be back in the Premier League. Rich, have you learned a lot today?
Yeah, a lot. I think one nice thing about Football Uncovered is that we, you know, there's a lot of commonalities between some of these characters, but also slightly different in their own unique and individual ways, which is just lovely. Imagine we could get everyone together at a dinner party, all these like great football owners. I think that'd be fantastic. We can all talk about the best and worst ways to run a football club. What do you think about that?
Well, Nick, is that something you could organise if you just put a few calls out?
Yeah, I'll make some calls. Should we do that on season two? We'll start with a Zoom party.
I was actually intimidated at just the thought of that, just these eight people popping up. Anyway, we digress. Who would you like to, which eight fraudulent football owners would you like to sit around the table?
Alive
with?
Or dead?
Alive or dead. Do let us know. Nick, thank you very much for everything. Rich, thank you as well. If you have enjoyed it, let us know on Apple by dropping us a review and a rating. And if you want to follow me and Rich, follow at Sporf and drop us, you know, a tale if you want to dig us a bit deeper for the next series and beyond. And if you want to follow Nick Harris, follow at Sport and Intel. This has been Football Uncovered. Cheers.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. TNCs apply. Available in app only.